supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In Pennsylvania, school boards have a lot of latitude to tax and spend, though limited by state law. But that was challenged in August when a Montgomery County judge ordered Lower Merion School Board to rescind a planned tax hike. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that the case came before an appeals court today.
Attorney and Lower Merion resident Arthur Wolk filed the suit back in February, alleging the school district illegally raised taxes to sock away in rainy day funds.
My upset is not over the great school. My upset is charging us more than that. In other words, they took $60 million of taxpayer money over and above what was necessary to fund their schools.
Lower Merion officials argue the increases are legal and their fund balances will help cover future expenses in the high-performing, high-spending district, like pension costs, which are hitting record levels statewide. Lawyer for the district, Alicia Hickok, says Wolk's politics are another factor in the suit.
He has a different philosophy in that he believes that, number one, you should spend less on education, and number two, that you should spend everything you have down to zero.
Wolk says he doesn't think public schools should try to rival private ones in terms of course offerings or amenities. Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials, Jay Himes, says it's up to the state and the legislature to determine if school boards are taxing too much, which raises a question.
Should the courts be second-guessing decisions made by school boards about taxes and budgets? I mean, we would certainly submit that no, they shouldn't be.
He says if the Commonwealth Court upholds a lower court's decision, school districts will have to, quote, reinvent the wheel when it comes to their budgets. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Every day, thousands of motorists along the New Jersey Turnpike pass a huge skeleton of a building. It looks a little like an oversized shipping container. It's supposed to become the nation's biggest shopping mall, known as American Dream. But that dream to date has been more akin to a nightmare. Years of delays and big questions about its business model. A series looking at the effort, it was produced through a reporting collaboration between WNYC, NJ Spotlight, and Bloomberg Business Week. What do you say we go shopping with NJ Spotlight's John Reitmeier? John, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, for those of us down in the South Jersey, Philadelphia area who haven't seen it yet, tell us about this project. When did it start? What was the dream?
Well, this actually goes back to the early 2000s under prior governor. It's a planned mega mall. Right now, the plans call for 3 million square feet of both retail and entertainment space. And when I say entertainment, I mean amusement park, water park, indoor ice skating rink. This was something that was envisioned for the Meadowlands as sort of an economic development project, and it struggled to survive. Two prior developers failed to get it to the finish line, and when Governor Chris Christie took office in early 2010, he made the decision to keep trying to get this project completed, and he brought on a company called Triple Five, which is the owner of the Mall of America in Minnesota, to give it a go. And so right now, Triple Five has been working for the last few years to draw up new plans, expanded the project, and now they're in the midst of trying to gather the financing that they need to resume, fully resume construction at the site and fulfill their broader vision for it.
How did Governor Christie's feelings evolve on this matter? He was against it before he was for it.
Yeah, as a candidate, he was in 2009. He was critical of the project, and his transition team produced a report that called the business model a failed business model. So part of our analysis on this has been to kind of look at this from some of the big picture perspectives, like, you know, will people still want to go to a mall? This is envisioned to open in fall of 2018. You know, will we be getting our gifts via drone from Amazon at that time?
The NJ Economic Development Authority is offering a very sweet deal to the developer should it come to fruition.
Yeah, one of the tax incentives that Triple Five has been approved to benefit from is a sales tax break, basically, where the state doesn't write a blank check. You have to earn your tax incentive by opening and turning a profit. And so this one is worth up to $390 million, which is the largest that the Economic Development Authority has approved.
What, in turn, is the anticipated benefit that will come back to the state?
The EDA estimated there's a net benefit from the project for New Jersey of an estimated $730 million spread out over 20 years. Now, I should say the developer, Triple Five, has more lofty economic projections and also estimates the there will be more jobs created by the project.
And are they the type of jobs that residents in that vicinity can afford to live on?
What we found by looking at the EDA's records, most of the jobs will come with a salary of less than $20,000, which in northern New Jersey, according to affordable housing advocates, is not enough to pay for the average one-bedroom apartment.
John, thanks once again for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome.
NJ Spotlight, John Reitmeier, and you can access this series. It's a collaboration between WNYC, NJ Spotlight, and Bloomberg Business Week. We'll have a link at our website, newsworks.org. Under Governor Tom Wolf, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection promised a renewed focus on environmental justice to protect marginalized communities of minorities and people in poverty who often bear the brunt of industrial development. But at a recent public meeting in Harrisburg, two DEP advisory panels, including one tasked specifically with environmental justice, ignored a woman from a low-income area who'd driven hundreds of miles to voice her concerns. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, the committees then spent over an hour discussing ways to improve public engagement.
Greene County's Ryerson Station State Park is a special place for Veronica Coptis. She spent time as a child there fishing with her father. It's also where she got married. So when she heard CONSOL Energy would be allowed to do more coal mining under the park, she was concerned. After all, the state had blamed it for destroying the park's lake a decade ago. Coptis drove 200 miles to a public meeting in Harrisburg to state her case.
And I had to find a babysitter for my three-month-old daughter. I don't have, my car needs tires. I don't have money to fix it right now, so I had to borrow a car.
Coptis works for the environmental advocacy group, the Center for Coalfield Justice, and she's talked to a lot of government agencies before. Both her home and the state park are in areas officially designated as environmental justice zones.
And this is the first time I've ever blatantly felt like I didn't matter and I wasted my time and I wasn't heard.
That's because after she briefly shared her concerns, Coptis said she'd heard the permit had already been issued.
And I just wanted the acting secretary to tell me what the status of the permit was. Was it issued? Was it not? Were they still deciding? Is there, like, it's okay if he didn't know? And there was just no response whatsoever.
Actually, there was a response. The DEP's director of external affairs said the agency could only accept public comments and couldn't respond. Coptis says she felt insulted because there were no other members of the public making comments or asking any questions, and the gathering was a joint meeting of the agency's Citizens Advisory Council and Environmental Justice Advisory Board, two committees charged with ensuring robust public participation. And ironically, here's what happened after Coptis left the room. DEP's acting secretary, Patrick McDonnell, got up to give a PowerPoint presentation on the department's public participation policies. The panels then spent more than an hour discussing ways to better engage with the public. They took out Sharpies to brainstorm ideas on big sheets of paper. Then they put colorful stickers next to the ideas they liked the best. Joanne Kilgour, who heads the state chapter of the Sierra Club, was at the meeting and says she was disappointed so much effort went into theoretical rather than actual public participation.
These are often the only fora that community members have to access, once removed, members of the administration and the decision makers who are making key decisions that affect their daily lives. It's not just insulting, it runs counter to the very principles of our democracy.
McDonald says he was caught off guard by the incident with Koptis and wished things had gone differently.
My hope was that she was like going to sit down, so maybe we could have had a conversation afterward, but she left.
After she left DEP, Koptis went to prearranged meetings with the governor's office and the State Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, which manages the park. She does expect to hear back from the DEP either in an email or with an offer to meet. And it turns out she was right. The agency did issue the mining permit. But she wants to bring more sunshine to the process.
I don't want these behind closed door conversations. This administration prides itself on transparency. So I want this to be transparent on the record for media to have access to it, for community members to have access to it. These behind closed doors conversations are just part of the problem of how permitting happens in Pennsylvania.
Horace Strand is a member of the DEP's Environmental Justice Advisory Board. He says the agency was just following protocol around taking public comments, but that should probably change.
I think that we have to revisit the protocol and make it more friendly towards citizens who invest their time and effort to come here.
A spokesman for CONSOL says the new permit is a success story and says the company is working closely with the governor's office to ensure rigorous environmental compliance. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Living in poverty is a constant juggling act, often filled with frustration and heartbreak. Seems obvious. But for those whose job it is to work with poor people day in and day out, that emotional impact can get lost in the shuffle. WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports that Philadelphia's anti-poverty initiative is trying to change that.
On any other day, Colleen Young is an intake leader for Child Care Information Services of Philadelphia. She works with the county assistance office to help match low-income families with a daycare center they can afford. But on this morning, on the 11th floor of a Center City office building, she's Nancy Nathan, a single mom supporting three kids on a minimum wage job at a hospital.
I take home $278 a week, and I get $239 in food stamps. My rent is $335 minus clothes and miscellaneous expenses. I'm already in the hole.
Young is playing the role as part of a two-hour simulation exercise called the Poverty Experience. A big part of the training is to remind employees like Young that injecting empathy and compassion into their daily interactions can go a long way when working with people who often feel others don't understand their struggle. Mitch Little is executive director of the Mayor's Office of Community Empowerment, which organized the experience.
There's a level of fatigue that folks don't often recognize. Folks who do this work do it tirelessly. They are often the first to give of themselves and sacrifice of themselves. And in doing that, sometimes you forget. And so what happens to everybody when they're fatigued? Sometimes they get a little shorter or impatient. Sometimes they look for shortcuts because they have so much to do.
The Natans are one of roughly 15 families in the room. Their goal, try to survive a month in the shoes of a low-income family. They've got to keep their house safe, food in the fridge, pay utility bills and loans, and be prepared to deal with whatever curveballs life throws at them. Soon after the exercise starts, the Natans get word that the family's home was broken into. They've lost everything.
So that means our refrigerator, TV, furniture, stove, so I can't even go to the pawn shop.
Things don't get much easier from there. Like millions of families living in poverty, Nancy Nathan doesn't have a bank account, so she brings her paychecks to a check cashing place, which charges considerable fees for its services. Week to week, there's always something that isn't being paid off so something else can, a loan, rent. Even when Nathan lays out cash for a bill, problems come up.
Hi, how are you?
How are you?
Your name is?
Nancy Nathan.
Me.
For 5214 First Street.
At the utilities office, Young cuts a deal because she doesn't have enough to cover the entire bill. She puts down $180 against a $213 total and agrees to pass the balance onto the next payment cycle. But she walks away without a receipt, no proof of her agreement. Later in the exercise, she gets rebilled for the total amount. Bernie Lopez with the mayor's office says he isn't surprised. He says the stress of trying to solve problem after problem to make ends meet can lead to simple but costly mistakes.
It's difficult because, you know, I'm pretty sure she's dealing with not only her utilities, her children, her family, trying to feed her home, trying to keep a roof over her head, make sure the kids are going to school, make sure they got clothing. It's a lot. and she's a single mother, you know, it's rough.
By the end of the experience, Young presses her hand to her head and lets out a sigh. It's only been an hour.
It's just like every time I try to play catch-up, it's like I'm knocked back 10 steps.
Young says the training was eye-opening.
Definitely to get a better understanding of what our clients go through and the difficulties they face. So when they come into our office and they're frustrated, it's not that they're frustrated at us, per se. It's just they're frustrated at everything that they're dealing with and they have to go through, and this is just one extra step they have to take.
Another person doing the role-playing is Jacqueline Elwell, who manages the volunteer department at PhilAbundance, the hunger relief organization. She says the experience made her realize just how many departments and organizations people in poverty interact with, just to get through each month.
I think it's so easy in a city as large as Philadelphia and with such diverse needs and deep needs to get siloed in the work that we do and think like, okay, I'm just going to get people food and that's what I'm going to do and that's all I'm going to know about. But as I saw today, it's so much bigger.
Elwell says she wants to learn more about agencies that help people with issues other than food so she can point them in the right direction. The exercise is part of a larger push to make the city's anti-poverty work more collaborative and personal. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
As the holiday season draws near, let's summon the sounds of Christmas. Joining me are members of The Crossing, a Philadelphia-based choir specializing in contemporary music, a quartet of singers, Stephen Bradshaw.
Hey, Dave.
Maren Maltabano.
Hi there.
Robbie Eisentrout.
Thanks for having us.
Rebecca Seiler.
Hello.
And The Crossing conductor, Donald Nally.
Thanks, Dave.
Welcome, one and all. Donald, you founded The Crossing in 2005. What was its initial mission or intent, and how has it evolved?
Well, we were a bunch of friends who just wanted to sing together, so we decided we'll do a concert, and here we are, 11 years later, and we just have grown and grown, and we loved singing new music together, and so we just made it our mission to commission composers that we really love.
And I understand this quartet is representative of some 24 singers.
Yes. Our singers are really high level, so they're really busy doing all sorts of things, so we have a roster of about 32 or so that we draw from to make those 24.
In addition to conducting, you are in charge of imaging, programming, commissioning.
Yes, I do a lot of the dreaming.
And so how do you have time to design programs? Here we are one day out from The Crossing at Philadelphia and then Saturday in Wilmington.
A lot of the commissioning that we do is 2 or 3 years out, so the programs begin to take form long, long before they're actually sung. So what you're going to hear Friday night involves pieces that have been thought about or talked about for a couple of years. There's a commissioned by Aaron Helgeson, and that'll be a world premiere. It's a really beautiful piece based on a novel of Marguerite Duras. And, you know, then I know what that piece is going to be, and all the rest of the pieces sort of fall around it to make a story.
Rebecca Seiler, one of the compositions in the program is the premiere tomorrow night, Last Spring, David Lang. Tell us about it.
Last Spring is actually going to be a U.S. premiere for us. It was written for the Edvard Grieg Choir. The text is actually a setting that Edvard Grieg himself set, and it's going to open and close our program tomorrow evening, giving it a nice bookend. And it was written in memory of David's friend Kippy Stroud, who is a philanthropist here in Philadelphia as well, and she was the founder of the Fabric Workshop.
And we are fortunate enough to have you do an in-studio performance. Let's give a listen.
One more time I saw the spring. One more time I saw the cherries blossom. One more time I heard the ice break. One more time I saw the snow melt. More time, 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 more time.
Singers, describe the preparation for a performance, especially during cold and flu season at hand.
Our body is our instrument. Taking care of it is the priority when it comes to any musical concert and any season and life in general. What we do before each rehearsal, or what we're supposed to do, is warm up and then sing healthily. Part of the beauty of The Crossing is the intonation that comes in every concert, and that comes from us singing straight tone as opposed to vibrato. Straight tone is tricky because it's not the natural voice for anyone. So warming up is especially needed to do something like The Crossing. But then when you do straight tone, you get something that's beyond the natural performance.
Donald, I was surprised by the range of collaborative projects from Tempesta di Mare Baroque Chamber Orchestra, Prism Saxophone, and am I reading this correctly, the Rolling Stones?
We were the Can't Always Get What You Want choir.
You were that
choir.
Yeah.
When they came to Philadelphia on tour 2 years ago, they used that as the first encore on their 50th anniversary tour. They've kind of completed their concert, and then the lights come up, and there's these two choirs of 12 members each on each side of the stage, and the crowd just goes crazy. And it's a very different environment because we're used to people that sit quietly and listen intently and aren't a part of the music. The 15,000 people there are like a part of it. The energy of the room is a part of the whole event.
Donald Nally, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks also to Stephen Bradshaw, Marin Montalbano, Robbie Eisentrout, and Rebecca Seiler. You can hear more of our conversation and more music at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.